what's the worst thing they could do? Kick you off the committee?
Good afternoon. Welcome to House Committee on Transportation Economic Development. Monday. We have three bills to take up today. We'll start with a public hearing on House Bill 2338. Representative Greenlee, if you'd like to join us. Troy, you can give us the summary, please.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2338 creates 17-member task force on extending the West Side Express Service commuter light rail to Salem, Oregon, includes governor's appointees representing cities and counties, the 5th Congressional District, TriMet, the Oregon Senate, the Oregon House of Representatives, the Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and Portland and Western Railroad. Requires task force to explore the possibility of extending the commuter light rail to Wilsonville, from Wilsonville to Salem, and developing and implement a program designed to generate interest and activity in extending a commuter line. Stipulates that the task force shall report to the Legislative Assembly and may include recommendations for legislation. Requires the Legislative Assembly Administration Committee shall provide staff support to the task force. Declares emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlee, House District 33, which is Portland out west into Washington County. And I appreciate you hearing this bill. From the time West was started, the West Side Express line between, sort of express line between Beaverton and Wilson, it struck me that it would make a ton of sense to extend that line down the right-of-way that was already there all the way to Salem. And about for the last 4 years, I've been talking to people on and off, folks listed in the possibility for this commission on how important it would be to us to envision the ability to go from Salem to Portland, Salem into Beaverton, there to pick up Max and go to the airport and a variety of other places. And that's why this bill is before you, to begin to continue to push on this. It took more than 15 years to get the Beaverton to Wilsonville piece of this, and I've been assured if we were going to do this, it would take another 15 or 17 years. Since I introduced the bill, and since I asked you to hear it, I've met with ODOT, and ODOT has convinced me that the study they're doing on, higher speed rail between Eugene and Portland has in their charge the requirement to look at commuter rail, and in fact, the route that it would make sense, the Portland Electric route that goes on to Eugene is in their study. So I'm not exactly confident, but I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt that, in fact, they'll be asking the kind of questions about this commuter line as a part of the larger, higher-speed environmental impacts study that they're doing. And I will be happy to have you not consider this bill any further.
Thank you, Representative. So I'll note that there are three other people who have signed up to testify. I hope they all heard that last statement. Representative Greenlee is confident that ODOT is going to explore the questions without further action on this bill. I have that correct?
Yes, you have that correct. That's my perception. That's
thank, right. Thank you very much. Any questions for Representative Greenlee?
I'd just like to make one comment. The West goes through Tigard, and we're actually looking at Tigard in a development to bring more business into downtown Tigard, as having West as kind of the focal point and a gathering place and that kind of thing. So
can't you imagine? And also, say, I know when I met with the Kaiser people, Mr. Chair, Representative Dorey, they imagined that Kaiser could become a residential community for Wilsonville, where there's a lot of industrial development. And that's why the mayor of Kaiser, at the time we first started talking about this, was very excited, because they imagined that taking some of the housing pressure off of Portland for Wilsonville and then using this as a way to commute to Wilsonville from Kaiser.
Thank you.
So thank
the three
you,
people
Chair.
Who have signed up to testify are Hal Gard, John Charles, and Donald Leap. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, My name's Hal Gard. I'm the Rail and Public Transit Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I appreciate your time this afternoon. I really don't want to repeat what Representative Greenlich said, so I'm just going to kind of summarize. In 2009, the legislature directed ODOT to conduct a detailed assessment of rail across the state. Part of that assessment was a review of the Wilsonville to Salem commuter rail segment. The results of that are found in Appendix I of the ODOT rail study. And we really found three things in the course of that study. We determined that it was feasible to conduct that, or to establish that service. Costs in 2010 dollars were about $350 million, and that in order to pursue that option any further, we would need to conduct a detailed alternatives analysis and an EIS. Subsequent to that, in August of this past year, we initiated a corridor investment plan and an EIS for intercity rail between Eugene and Portland. The Wilsonville to Salem segment is included as part of the alternatives of that piece. So essentially, in our discussions with Representative Greenlich, the timing is not quite right for an additional study because the results of that current EIS will significantly inform the overall question of commuter rail between Wilsonville and Salem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Charles?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Charles with the Cascade Policy Institute. Just here to provide some background on the subject that I gave some materials to the committee assistant. If someone does want to expand west, they should be prepared that it's a huge money pit. It loses about $14 per boarding or about $18 per originating ride. And the forecasted ridership was $2,500 or 2,500 boardings in the opening year, and it's only up to about 1,600 4 years later. And TriMet is also in a financial crisis in which they apparently will be self-destructing within about the next 5 years. So this probably is not a great time for them to expand to another city or another state, as they might be in another context. And secondly, I just want to let you know that at the end of the Wilsonville line, when you get off now, you just walk 100 yards and get on an express bus operated by, alternatively, SMART of Wilsonville or Chariots of Salem, and you get back on the freeway and you go down here and it takes you right to the front door for another $3. It's really efficient. So there's no particular need, as much as I like West and as much as I like trains, there's no particular need to do this. I think sometimes the bus doesn't get the respect it deserves, and rubber-tired transit on an existing road network is extremely cheap in comparison. So if somebody wants to go forward with this and they have the money, that's fine, but I don't think there's a need for it. And I'm not sure, after the experience that Wilsonville and Washington County have had in sending money every month to TriMet to backfill for the subsidies, I'm not sure how many local governments might want to step up and subject themselves to similar pain. But if they want to, I like the ride, happy to take a subsidized trip, but probably not in the category of a need, more in the category of a want. So, thanks.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Lee?
For the record, Donald Leap, Government Affairs Director, Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates, Representative Reed, Chair, Representative Benz, Vice Chair, Representative Gorsk, committee members. I just want to, I've handed in some testimony prepared by AORTA President Dan McFarling for your perusal. I just wanted to make a couple of notes here, which is going to pretty well dovetail into some of the other comments made. But AORTA has consistently viewed the Union Pacific as, with its main line, as the proper location, the best route for intercity passenger service. At the same time, we have always supported the development of this route, which is called the Oregon Electric, operated now by the PNW, as a place as a, for good future commuter service. Unfortunately, it suffers from narrow rights of way, streets running, and somewhat restricted speeds because of curvature, which make it, in my opinion, less suitable for the inner city service. But for commuter service, we think it's really a thing that the state should be looking for. We know that the rail study that Mr. Gard was speaking of will encompass that in the rail study. So from therefore, we would like to just simply support that this task force also consider in its list of members that there maybe be somebody from the rail advocacy community be brought into this also to bring a little different viewpoint when the time comes to actually make this presentation to look at the form of this task force. And that's all. Thank you very much for
Thank
your time.
Thank you. And I'm not sure if you came in when Representative Greenlick was testifying, but he heard testimony from him that he's confident that or feels good about the possibility of ODOT considering this question within some of their existing policies. So he's not advocating moving forward with the concept. I would note on your written testimony there's a discussion of carbon tax, and you and Mr. McFarlane may find interesting the hearing that the House and Senate Revenue Committees are going to have later this week together to hear Dr. Potowski's report on that. So we may have that discussion as well. Representative Gorsuch.
Would it be possible to ask a question of the ODOT representative?
I think so.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Go ahead, Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your overall study, in looking at this, and we've been focusing on the fact that West basically ends at Beaverton, have you considered the fact that there is another PNW route through Milwaukee that connects up to this and into the UP line and into Union Station?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grozick, I have the project manager of the corridor improvement plan and the environmental impact statement here. If you mind, I'd like to ask Mr. Jim Cox to come up, and he can give you much better detail than I can.
Thank you.
Please start by introducing yourself.
Thank you. I'm Jim Cox. I'm the project manager for ODOT for the Oregon Passenger Rail Study. And could you repeat your question, please?
It's all part of the connection. If you leave the PNW out near I-5 and you go down through Lake Oswego on their secondary line, you can cross the Willamette River into Milwaukee, and then it ties into the UP line near the Brooklyn Yard and takes you, that would conceivably take you to Union Station.
Correct.
I think one of the problems that was raised from our Cascade policy person is that it's truncated. It stops at Beaverton, and then you have to transfer. Is it possible in your study that there is at least some consideration of something that would originate at Union Station and tie into this system?
We did look at an alternative that used that alignment, basically followed the Oregon Electric up to Tualatin and then mm-hmm. transitioned over onto the Tillamook Branch, as you said, through Lake Oswego and into Milwaukee.
Right.
There was significant community impacts using that alternative, and the Leadership Council decided to drop that for consideration in January.
Great. Thank you.
So we looked at it, yes.
All right. That's all I have.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. That's the entire list of people who want to be heard in House Bill 2338. And based on its sponsor's testimony, this is probably the last chance to talk about House Bill 2338. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard? I don't see any. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2338. And open the public hearing on House Bill 3136.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 3136 allows court to dismiss citation issued for offense of operating vehicle with illegal window tinting or reduce fines that the court would otherwise have imposed for offense if defendant establishes that tinting has been modified to comply with statutory requirements.
Representative Nathanson, and I'm going to ask Jack Dempsey to join you as he's the only other person who has signed up to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. This bill that I'm proposing to you comes out of comments that I received from several constituents who had been really annoyed about windows that were tinted too dark in cars. They were speaking to me as a pedestrian, in one case as a bicyclist, but usually it was from the point of view of a pedestrian, and I admit I had to agree with them. They were talking about not only was it annoying that you couldn't see if the driver saw you before you were trying to cross the street or pass beside the vehicle, but it's downright dangerous sometimes, especially when the car might be making a, you can tell the car is going to be making a turning movement and you're trying to figure out if it's safe to cross the street. If you can't catch the driver's eye, you don't know if they've looked in your direction or not. You really don't feel safe stepping off a curb as a pedestrian or taking any action as a bicyclist. And even as a driver, when you're next to someone and the window is too dark, you can't tell if they saw that you were in the lane next to them. Tinted windows are a safety hazard, not just for pedestrians, bicyclists, and other drivers. It's also a terrible potential safety hazard for law enforcement. If you can't see who's inside and what's inside when you walk up to that vehicle. I talked with a state trooper about this problem and found out how many tickets are issued by the state police in a year. In 2010, for example, it was about 1,400. Local law enforcement issues tickets also. I asked the state trooper what he thought we could do about the situation. The point is not to keep collecting fines. The point is to try to bring the tinting into compliance and improve safety and eliminate the hazard. So the idea is to make this what's called a fix-it ticket. There are tickets, other tickets described in statute that are called fix-it tickets. For example, when you bring a noisy muffler into compliance, you get it fixed, or improper fenders or mud guards. The statutes are very clear about allowing judicial discretion to lower or dismiss fines for certain violations, but it was not clearly described for window tinting. So this bill just brings window tinting into the same category as some of these other vehicle operation issues. So the objective is to improve public safety for law enforcement, for pedestrians, cyclists, other drivers. It provides an incentive to remove the safety hazard. It's going to make it clear judges still have the discretion about whether to waive or dismiss or reduce the fine, whatever they think is appropriate. If the person has been fined for the same violation before, they're likely not to waive or dismiss a second time, for example. If the person keeps putting tinting back onto the window, I just think this would be the type of thing that's an incentive for people to do the right thing instead of just pay a fine and keep providing this potential safety hazard for too many people. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nansen. Mr. Dempsey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Jack Dempsey representing the Oregon State Police Officers Association and the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I want to testify in support of 3136, and I want to thank the sponsor for bringing this forward. As she mentioned, excessive window tinting is a different type of equipment violation when it comes to police officers. You know, it can create a potentially hazardous situation. We like the approach on this. There's been a number of jurisdictions around the state that have done different versions of fix-it tickets, whether it's, you know, headlights or mufflers or all kinds of things. And we think for window tinting, this is a right approach, and we'll, you know, hopefully get a lot of these folks to take the stuff off their cars and go from there. So thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Bitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question is, what happens now? But that this bill would change. What's the process now? Because the statute, of course, says that they commit the offense as the law currently stands.
Right. They can commit the offense. If they get pulled over, they get cited. They can pay the citation and can go about their business. This can happen over and over again a number of times. And as Representative Nathan said, we would like to solve this problem. And if you give somebody an option to say, we're going to waive this offense if you can prove that you've actually taken this off, ideally it's going to encourage more folks to do that.
What's the fine?
Oh, I don't have that information, but I can find out and get back to you.
Here.
You have that? Showing a Class B traffic violation at $260.
260. So the incentive is pay the $260 or have your windows...
Or change the window tinting.
Mm-hmm. And we don't know what the cost of... Anybody know what the cost of changing... You do? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz, members of the committee, yes, we've called around to some auto repair shops and other places that might be involved, and it looks like the charges vary from around $150 to $200 usually for the typical time involved to remove the tinting from all the windows. Depending on what kind of vehicle you're driving, it may be only the windshield in the front two windows that you need to reduce the amount of tinting or remove it. Some tinting is allowed, of course, up to a certain level. So whether they choose to remove it entirely or replace it with something not so tinted, that's their choice. But it looks like it's $150 to $200 on the average to remove it from all the windows. If you're removing it from the rear windshield also, and that has window defroster wires on it, that involves some more time because you have to be much more careful. So the entire cost, including rear windshield with defroster, is $300. But that's usually not required to comply with the law.
And Representative Bentz, just so you know, my daughter will do it for free by scratching.
Representative out of business.
Indeed. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That completes the list, the long list of people sign up on 3136. Anyone else want to be heard on 3136? I don't see any. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3136. Troy, we have all the paperwork, so
yes, we do.
Open a work session on House Bill 3136. Representative
Bentz? Mr. Chair, move House Bill 3136 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves House Bill 3136 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? I don't see any. The motion carries. House Bill 3136 goes to the floor. Who shall we have carry it? Representative Nathanson?
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nathanson will carry, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 3136. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3137. You didn't have to come back up, I suppose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 3137-1 permits person to provide Department of Transportation with odometer reading for vehicle 10 years old or older, requires upon transfer of any interest in motor vehicle an odometer disclosure statement that shall be made by the transferee to the transferor to the transferee, requires department to keep two most recent odometer records in electronic form. And committee members, we do have the dash one amendment, which has been uploaded to OLS. If you should like a hard copy, I believe we have a hard copies for you as well.
Okay.
And we have all the paperwork, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Please. And while you're getting settled, we have a number, so we'll stick with you by yourself for now, and then we'll call the others up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Nancy Nathanson, House District 13. Odometer fraud, or rolling back the mileage, isn't a new problem, but we can do better to find and stop the people responsible for it. The objective of this bill is to help consumers, to help business, and to help law enforcement agencies to avoid the cost of dishonest business practices by recording odometer readings regardless of the age of the vehicle. I was really surprised to learn that apparently we as a state care only about the first 10 years of the vehicle's life, and after that we don't care so much. Actually, we've got a number of older cars on the road, and we really ought to care. Odometer fraud isn't just a nuisance problem. It costs Oregonians millions of dollars a year, and this is how. The lower mileage means the vehicle price is inflated, the cost of insurance is higher, and the buyer probably did not factor in how much it's going to cost in operations and maintenance, depending on the kind of car and how old it was. Both consumers and businesses have an interest in being protected from this kind of fraud. We can do something to help. We can direct the Department of Motor Vehicles to keep odometer readings on vehicles regardless of the vehicle age. I'll just give you the shorthand version and hope that you will support this bill. There are other people behind me prepared to testify with a lot more detailed information. But the shorthand version is federal law prohibits disconnecting, resetting, or altering a motor vehicle's odometer with the intent to change the number of miles indicated. And it requires the seller to provide written information on the vehicle title when the ownership is transferred. But federal law exempts older vehicles, 10 years or older, from written disclosure. That is an especially big hole considering the number of older cars being bought and sold. In Oregon, we can do better than what the federal government does. DMV maintains the most recent odometer reading on vehicles less than 10 years old. They comply with federal law. That's great. But after that 10th birthday, DMV will not update the reading, even when the odometer reading is provided voluntarily by the person on a form. More than half of the cars are over 10 years old, half of the cars in Oregon. Nearly half of the time for those cars, people are voluntarily submitting the odometer reading. So why not keep it? This bill just says keep it. It's good information. Is odometer fraud a problem in Oregon? Yes, it is. You will probably hear about a couple of high-profile stories that were in the news a year and 2 years ago. Based on projections from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Oregon would have over 5,400 instances a year. That's an awful lot of rollbacks on mileage. The federal government publishes the information about odometer fraud on the NHTSA website, and I can give you that if you want. It's real simple. NHTSA.gov/, and then you look up vehicle safety and odometer fraud. There's an amendment that we've prepared, which I hope you will consider. It's technical. It was written to maintain the most two recent readings. We think it's appropriate to say just the most recent one. I hope that you will support this pro-consumer and pro-business bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nansen. Are there any questions before she joins us back up here? I don't see any. Thank you very much.
We have four people to testify, so let's have Monty King, Eric Page, and Daryl Fuller, please. And you can drag one of those other chairs up there. Thanks. Okay. The sequence is up to you, gentlemen.
I guess I'm first.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Monty King. I'm president of Oregon Vehicle Dealers, Oregon Power Sports Association, executive director of the Auto Appraisers of Oregon. Been working for dealers for about 30 years. When I was with Auto Trader one time, one of my staff walked into the office of a dealer, went in the back to see if they had any ads, and walked in on him as he's got a drill going backwards on an odometer. Okay, so we're talking odometer fraud. Are there dealers doing it? You bet there are. In the materials that I gave you, there is a YouTube address, and it shows you a TV station in Seattle that did an undercover sting on a guy, and he's been in all kinds of odometers. There was 19 dealers caught back in New Jersey who had been spinning odometers for 20 years. Wholesale, selling them to dealers who sold them for more. All those bad stories. You know, California last year passed a bill effective July 1st, 2012 that required every dealer who sold somebody a used car in California to give the consumer a report, a vehicle history report. My goodness. Now, I don't like really what I don't like people saying California did this and all that kind of stuff. I don't like it either. I'm an Oregonian, but once in a while they did get a good idea. The NMVTIS system that they're attached to, that they required to be given to people, cost the dealer $1. And Carfax and AutoCheck went into the legislature and said, hey, how about us? They said, no. NMVTIS is fine with us. Well, Oregon doesn't do the NMVTIS either. And when I called over there, they said, hey, when are we going to join? And basically the answer was probably never. So we have no plans in Oregon for our government to be involved in protecting the assets of the consumer. I think that's unfortunate. For less than a penny a person in the state of Oregon, one-time fee, we can do better. like Representative Nathanson said, I know we can do better. I know there are people out here who are doing things. We see them at the auctions, and Mr. Page is going to talk about that. He's been at the auctions for 30 years. We know there's wholesalers out there buying vehicles, and they're doing a Carfax report on their handheld, looking at a vehicle they want to buy. And they can see, oh, there's no vehicle reports on this car. Ooh, good one to roll back. Somebody told me the other day they just traded in their 10-year-old car. The last time I had an odometer statement was when it was brand new. So now at 10 years old, it's going to go into the system, and there's going to be no odometer report of this sale when he just traded it in. That's prime stuff for the bad guys. Representative Nathan Salsa said that cars are older. 22 years old now. When this law was passed, and it was passed here at the Oregon Legislature, 1990-ish, round in there, okay, cars only lasted 9 years old. That was the average age of a car was 10 years old. Now it's over 22 years old for a car. How many of you are driving vehicles 10 years and older? Okay? And none of those cars are going to be protected. So I think we can do better. I know we can. And I'm going to bring this bill back to this legislature session after session after session after session until you pass it. Okay? So just fair warning. Okay, just I probably talked too long already. Daryl's getting me antsy over here.
Who's next?
Mr. Chairman, representatives, is that working?
Yes, that's fine. Yes. Yep.
My name is Eric Page, and I've been licensed and bonded 30 years in the state of Oregon. I've been on all sides of the auto business, retail, wholesale, spent a lot of times at the auction. The economic times that we went through a few years back had changed the face of the car business dramatically. Used to be new car dealers, if a car had 50,000 miles on it, that was the cutoff. They didn't even keep that car for their inventory. There is a continuing shortage of used cars nationwide. The statistics on how many older, higher mileage vehicles are being traded on the used car market has gone way up. During the period of time that there was such a shortage of new cars being sold, in other words, coming into the market, the whole market shrunk, as well as in terms of numbers available, including during that time we went through a cash for clunkers program that removed a vast majority of vehicles off the market.
800,000.
800,000 vehicles disappeared from the market. So with this shrinking and pressure for dealers to acquire merchandise and the new world of mass media marketing, Craigslist, Facebook, and various other sources that people market merchandise on, you've got dealers, non-dealers, curbstoners attacking that media center to buy merchandise for their lots or to re-wholesale at auction or re-wholesale to other dealers. The person that is selling that car in their driveway that is not a curbstoner, just one of you, I've got a car my daughter used to drive, I'm going to get rid of it. What's the quickest way to get rid of it? Craigslist, I'm home on Saturday, I'll sell it. Somebody shows up to buy that car. As far as you know, it's past odometer requirements. So all you need to do is sign the title off. The guy's got cash. The car disappears. Let DMV know you've sold it. Therefore, that title doesn't end up, with a vehicle with towing or something against it. So if you've done your part, that vehicle disappears. You probably don't ever hear of it again. Well, that vehicle could very possibly, and in a lot of cases, shows up at the auction, and if it had an odometer that simply rolled over. It wasn't a 100,000-mile odometer. It just rolled back over to start over again. You've got a vehicle maybe running around that shows 85,000 miles on it that could be 285,000 miles on it. The individual selling that car had no intention of representing that his car, it's miles over, it's exempt. But the guy that's buying that car intends to represent it potentially very differently. So at least this state having an opportunity for the person selling that car to make a notation of that mileage should be available, in my opinion. I've taken a little bit of time here with the constraints of the car business tracking some vehicles recently on Craigslist. I was able to track just last week five vehicles that were on Craigslist on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, and they were all at the auction on Tuesday. We have an auction in Milwaukee, in Oregon. We have one, which is the Portland Auto Auction. We have Cascade Auto Auction, and we have the Auto Auction in Eugene. That's four auctions in the state of Oregon that are a dealer-only auction. And I can guarantee you there's a lot of dealer, non-dealer activity that is supplying those auctions with vehicles that do not have documented true mileage on them. It's just not possible for the numbers showing up of older vehicles with low mileage. It's not possible for it to be there. So I seriously recommend you sponsor, look at this bill. It's a simple box that should be available to the guy that's not a dealer to sell his vehicle and know that it's not easily going to get washed. So thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Page. Let's hear from Mr. Fuller, and then we may have questions for you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association. I'll make just two quick points, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions you have. Point one, there's no opposition to this bill that we know of. The only issue that I think we need to address is the cost. The second, just for the record, and it's in the testimony that we provided, the bill is supported by the Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association, the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association, the Auto Appraisers of Oregon, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and AARP. All of these people have an interest in knowing what the odometer readings are, of having a record that establishes those to make it easier to detect odometer fraud and to prosecute those that are violating the law. The committee mentioned that you had all the paperwork on the bill. I've looked all over OLIS, and it's kind of a new thing for me. I can't find a fiscal anywhere. So if there is one, I haven't seen it yet, and that's the only thing. The only concern we have is the cost to DMV in order to implement the bill, which we believe ought to be extremely low. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We do have a fiscal. I imagine we can get a copy to you momentarily, and I expect that will be the subject of some conversation after we're through with this panel. So we'll know that. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair,
thank you. I did want to make one further comment, and I just wanted to bring a little bit of clarity. I don't believe that we have a state where we have a serious problem with dealers focusing in, good dealers focusing in on buying this product to resell it and make money. I think there are, like with any business, there are some unscrupulous dealers doing that. I would say that there's more focus related to non-dealers, curbstoners, somebody trying to make a quick buck, something like that. But I believe there is also probably some venue of dealers that are unscrupulous, that are using this to their advantage along with it. So there's a lot of good dealers in the state that actually go by the book and aren't looking to try and pull the wool over somebody's eyes. So I did want to make that point.
Could make it, Chairman.
Yes.
If I could make a comment, Darrell Fuller again with OVDA, having seen the fiscal analysis, just make a point. We had a very similar bill to this 2 years ago that made it down to Ways and Means and died, but it didn't make it out of this committee. The bill 2 years ago would have required DMV to record all odometers in electronic form going forward. in the interim, as I learned more about this issue, one of the objections that DMV had is they were only keeping one odometer reading in electronic form and everything else was just in microfiche. And they were concerned that having to keep all of the odometer disclosures for the history of a vehicle would overburden their antiquated computer system. They just didn't have the storage capacity, which is why this bill only requires them to keep the most recent odometer disclosure. 2 years ago, with the burden of keeping all of the odometer records for all vehicles, the cost for the 2011-13 biennium was $60,000, mm-hmm. and there was no cost in the 2013-15 biennium. Now that we've pared it down where they're only having to keep the most recent record, substantially reducing the fiscal input, reducing the footprint of the bill, it is now going to be almost $90,000 this session and going to be another $45,000 2 years from now in order to do something less. The numbers baffle me. And I think that the numbers are an indication of the interest that DMV has in doing the bill as opposed to the actual cost of taking care of the bill.
Thank you for the preview of what I suspect we will be talking about in a little bit. I see a number of questions down here, and then we'll come back here. Representative Parrish, then Mintz, then Cameron.
So I'm just looking at this. I don't know what a vehicle 16,000 pounds is. It says it looks like that's an exclusion vehicle with a gross weight of 16,000 pounds. So can I assume this does not apply to commercial vehicle and box trucks and things like that? Or this is just, we're just talking about regular old, like I'm selling my minivan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parrish, it does work on vehicles under 16,000, I think. But all of those have odometers. Why wouldn't somebody want to protect their 26,000-pound vehicle on an odometer? And, you know, that's what DMV is not doing. Now, DMV is not a consumer group. We all know that.
Okay.
But they were assigned a little bit of consumerism when they got when they were told to do the first odometer back in 1989-90. They fought us then. They fought the association. We wanted the odometer readings in the record because we're the good guys. And now we are here. We are again, 20-some years later, doing the same fight again. Why wouldn't you want an odometer reading of a big truck? But if it's a 2-ton truck or 4-ton truck, or whatever. All those are still there. All the odometer readings should be done. You get into the heavy stuff, but equipment, no.
I guess I just read that to be the current statute, so I just didn't know if that was changing anything. But the current statute, as it stands, doesn't look like it prescribes this for big trucks or.
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
So that's.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a clarification issue for Mr. Fuller, on page 2, line 26. Of the bill, the sentence as amended will read, the department shall keep the most recent version of records. And then it goes on to say required under this paragraph. The term required, that can be read a couple of ways, but you're not saying that this is required. The only thing that's required is that ODOT keep these records.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. It is a voluntary disclosure on behalf of the consumer. It's a requirement for DMV to keep it in electronic form.
Exactly.
If it shows up.
If it shows up. Right.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do we still have somebody here from DMV in the audience?
We're going to have someone from DMV after this panel.
Okay, perfect. I have a question. And it goes back to the fiscal. I just want to point out that the Attorney General has determined that the use of highway funds for this activity is not allowed, and I'm just wondering where a title transfer fee goes, if it goes into highway funds, or if it's DMV other funds, because we can talk about why we would need general funds to do this. A couple questions I have, maybe for the process, and Mr. Page, great to see you today, and I've got a situation where I know somebody who has a 1986 box van, and it doesn't have the 100,000 mile, and that person may want to sell that here quickly if they wanted to know. They didn't want to lie. I mean, they wanted to know when they bought it. They didn't really know how would somebody go about finding out what the real miles are to actually report that. Do you have any idea?
If Representative Cameron, it would probably be difficult to track that down, and that's a situation where exempt actually has some sensibility to it, but in your case, so the odometer is showing if it's got, it's under the limitation of being able to go past 100,000 miles. So let's say it's showing 28,000 miles on it. So you don't know whether it's, well, you know it's not 28, but the smart thing for me in that case would be to say it's over and be able to denote that it's over, and maybe there's some way that that needs to be put into that that title, that if you're going to go ahead and stipulate it and record the mileage, so you are recording the mileage, but along with that you're recording that it is over.
So I would just excuse me, Mr. Chair, so there would be a place to just put in there unknown or don't know, or
check the over 100,000 miles, and then it gets recorded as we know it's over 100,000. At that point, it could be 200, 300,000.
I don't know that first digit.
But at least it gets that vehicle well into that higher mileage category. And in this case, you would probably, if this person's had this vehicle for a while, they know that it's over that, and that's how they want to sell it. And right now, we don't have that vehicle or that paperwork to be able to make sure that seller is stating, hey, this is over.
Follow up if I may.
Go ahead, please.
Yep. Do you have any idea what a 1986 Chevy box van with unknown mileage is worth?
I know a guy, too.
I know a guy. That's good.
What's the first digit of the odometer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, you actually asked a good question that indicates part of the reason why this is important. You can go to DMV now, and they keep all title transfer documents on microfiche. So if that box van that some unknown person had multiple owners during its lifetime, you could go back and look at all of those title transfer documents on microfiche. I don't know if DMV charges for it or how that works, but you can see that, but you can't get it on a Carfax. What this does, by requiring DMV to keep the most recent odometer reporting on the electronic record, Carfax grabs that stuff on a regular basis. So even though the record at DMV might change when a title transfer, Carfax is always going to have that older reading in its record. So when you do a Carfax report, it's going to give you all of those odometer readings over history, which will prevent you from having to go to the microfiche and get that history through DMV, because there's a private entity already out there that, as long as we make that number available to them on a regular basis, they're going to keep track of that for us.
Okay, thank you.
King? Mr. Chairman, Monty King, I just want to make you sure that you know, when he's talking about the five-digit odometers, that's not the majority of the cars now. Now we got you six-digit odometers, and they're electronic, right? They're easier. They're not hard to spin. They do it electronically. So, you know, we got to keep up with the times here.
So the digital, you can turn back.
There, Doherty.
Yes, thank you. I have a question. So the digital, you can turn back.
You have?
Okay. The digital odometers are easy to turn back,
yes,
on the new. Okay, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Representative Reed, no, Chairman Reed.
Any other questions? That's it. Representative Cameron.
It also has a lift gate on the back of the
automatic.
Representative Cameron, if parked in the way of me getting my snowmobile trailer into town that day, I'm sure it would have been worth a lot more.
Yeah, thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Please stick around in case we have some more questions. Ms. Joyce, I imagine you've had time to compile some answers to the questions the committee's been formulating.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, today representing the DMV. Passing on a little bit of written testimony, but just a couple of key points. Under the current system, DMV does record electronically those odometer readings that are required under federal law. So the 9 years and newer, they get put into the system, and when a title is printed out, they're printed there. The system as it is set up does not allow the entry of that odometer reading for vehicles that are older, using the VIN to determine that. Today, some customers do submit that information on forms, and that information is received. It goes into the paper document, into the microfilm or microfiche, but is not recorded electronically because of the constraints in the system. So what DMV would do to implement the bill is to change the system to allow the receipt of those odometer readings electronically for the older vehicles. And as noted by Representative Cameron earlier, it's been determined that this is not a constitutional use of the highway fund, so another source would need to be identified. And if I may, I did kind of write down a couple of responses to some of the questions that were asked. I'll do my best. In terms of the big trucks asked about by Representative Parrish, so under the federal law, they are exempt from an odometer disclosure regardless of age. So under the bill, the system set up to voluntarily receive those things, it would be keyed in, just as it would for your minivan. Representative Nathanson mentioned about, you know, whether or not we are concerned about consumer protection. Again, as she mentioned, it's the federal law where we get the 9 years and newer, or less than 10 years old. And there was reference to about what the most recent odometer reading is, and I think the person who testified was referencing Carfax. I think that's, you know, really probably what we're talking about here. Really, the most recent odometer reading you're going to see on a Carfax is whoever reported that most recently. I ran my Carfax this morning. I am proud to say I own a 20-year-old Subaru. And I purchased it about 18 years ago when I was much younger and had less gray hair. And the most recent odometer readings in the Carfax I pulled this morning were my most recent visits to Oil Can Henry's. So those are the most recent odometer readings there. But I am happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Representative Cameron.
So... thank you, Mr. Chair. So the
don't ask her about the liftgate truck.
No. I know she's not right. The one to ask that. I knew who to ask that question.
Okay.
I am in the market for a big truck. If anybody's
only Monday.
I probably could sell it for more to somebody who doesn't know what they're worth, right? No. So Oil Can Henry's is reporting your VIN number and ID mileage to Carfax.
Chair Reed and Representative Cameron, apparently so.
Might be another bill, Representative Cameron.
Yeah. Thank you. I had a follow-up. The title transfer dollars, where does that go?
Chair Reed and Representative Cameron, that money is going into the highway fund. My understanding, if the question is as to the determination that it's not highway fund eligible, that was a determination by Department of Justice. That was a determination made in 2011 when this bill was similarly up for consideration. I believe that the reasoning is that it is not a requirement. It's an optional thing that people may do, and therefore it's not necessary to the building and maintenance of the highways, and therefore that puts you in the column of not highway fund eligible.
Okay. Questions, Representative Nathanson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have been looking around on the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration information, and it specifically in the odometer fraud section, where the federal government is providing advice and assistance for consumers as well as for states. There's a very interesting section of information that I found. It's called financial assistance. I want to read just a couple of sentences to you verbatim because I found this pretty interesting. An essential part of the partnership is generating interest in the enforcement of odometer fraud by providing financial assistance through the Cooperative Reimbursable Agreement. This agreement was implemented to provide federal assistance to selected state agencies in support of their odometer fraud investigations and prosecutions. Those state agencies that have authority to enforce federal and or state odometer laws and regulations qualify for the one-year minimum $30,000 reimbursable agreement. And then it says states can apply for assistance to conduct investigations and prosecutions, file injunctions and recover damages for the consumer, conduct studies to detect weaknesses in motor vehicle laws, titling regulations, etc. And I think this is a weakness here, not recording the older one. Increase awareness through educational programs, sponsor, coordinator, participate in conferences. Anyway, I thought this was an intriguing possibility that I wondered if the state of Oregon has participated in the past or would consider doing in the future as a consumer protection and fraud reduction activity.
Chair Reed and Representative Nathanson, I appreciate you asking me that via email before the hearing so that I could look into it. And what I found was that DMV, anybody there is not aware that we've ever looked for that kind of money. What I would say, though, is that my understanding from looking at that website that was linked, the enforcement piece is a critical piece of that grant, and in terms of an enforcement authority on odometer fraud coming from the state, my understanding that is either Department of Justice, Oregon State Police, DMV is more in the nature of the keeper of the records as opposed to an actual enforcement body. But I can tell you we have, nobody's aware that we've ever pursued that kind of money.
Can I do a follow-up, please? Well, this seems like something just ripe for multi-department collaboration to have DOJ and state police and DMV to talk about. Is this, it's like applying for a grant, it seems. It's a reimbursable agreement. Seems like something intriguing for Oregon to consider. And because of Ms. Joyce's comments, it doesn't seem that DMV should have to shoulder the burden alone. Seems like those other departments should be involved. I'm also curious about the amount of the fiscal impact that has been mentioned, especially given the prior testimony by Mr. Fuller about how much it was a couple years ago, and it seems like it's less onerous this time, but costs more. How did we get to this number?
Chair Reed and Representative Nathanson. A couple of things. One is that the IT costs have actually gone down in that fiscal. As Mr. Fuller noted, it went from a more robust kind of IT work that would need to have been done under the original version of the 2011 bill to where we're at today with the base bill even and then the dash one. The IT cost therefore has actually gone down, the number of hours that it would take, although the rates that are charged for IT have gone up a little bit, but over the total number is down. What I can tell you is that it appears that DMV may be underestimated last session, and it has to do with the additional work that's believed or estimated to be needed to be done in terms of actual processing and things that happen with the titles. And so while the IT cost has gone down, the workload number has gone up. Particularly when we've got non-highway fund things involved, the estimates are necessary to be included as to what it's going to take, because we can't be using highway funds to do the work in any way, shape, or form.
One follow-up.
Go ahead.
I saw a copy of a more specific breakdown of the potential fiscal impact from the bill a couple years ago, and there there was $22,000 in staff time and then another $5,000 in staff training. And I'm thinking, an email saying to record this number now? You know, you're recording the number already for cars that are younger. Just tell people to record the number for a car regardless of its age. I'm trying to figure out how staff training is different from staff time and how this amounts to some tens of thousands of dollars.
I'd say, Representative Nathanson, that $5,000 for an email sounds like a good deal compared to a bill that I have that asks one agency to send an email to another agency once every quarter, and it's $8,000. So I can understand your frustration, though.
Let's commiserate. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm truly just I'm amazed at the estimate for the previous one, but I haven't seen a more specific breakdown for this one. I can't imagine what all must be involved and why it's going to cost that much, and does it mean the state would be actually spending that much additional money from some new source, or the value of time that we're asking people to spend would have been worth that much in dollars per hour of labor of people already employed?
Sounds like, at least for the moment, that's a bit of a rhetorical question. Mm-hmm. There's some more follow-up. Representative Benz?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is kind of along the same line. I was just looking at the bill, and it says that the department would write a rule for how this would happen, and then it says the department shall keep the records in electronic form. And I'm not sure if you read that to mean that they would be available online or what. So I'm asking you what you read that to mean the department had to do.
Chair Reed and Representative Bence, I can assure you it doesn't mean they'd be available online. In terms of, if I may ask where we're looking in the bill.
Essentially page 2, line 26. The department shall keep, and then there's an amendment, but the part that counts is in 26, which reads, required under this paragraph, in electronic form.
Right. Chair Reed and Representative Bence, we read that to mean that in the vehicle record that gets keyed in, that's where the odometer record would be kept. And as to the required piece, I mean, we understand that to be, whether it's required or voluntary under law, it's the thing that's being kept under this plan.
And then follow up, please. The fact that it would be entered electronically somehow and then retrievable somehow means that someone's going to get to see whatever it is that's been entered on a title. That's going to be the public's view of that information that's been voluntarily transmitted to the department. Am I right so far? In other words, someone brings in information after a car is 10 years old, the department receives it, the department enters it, and now I'm trying to figure out when someone's going to see that number and in what form. Is the only form they're going to see it on the face of the title?
Chair Reed and Representative Bence, under the bill, I think it would happen in a couple of ways. It would be visible. One, it would be visible when, in our Carfax situation, they receive that data and it can be then purchased. So that's one way it would show up electronically. Another way is that if someone wanted to get, for instance, the complete record on a vehicle, you can order up that complete microfilmed, microfished record and see all the documents, and it would be indicated there on the paper version. I think that's it.
And what I'm trying to get to is the point you make on in the report, where you note that putting that number on the official title gives it an aura of reliability.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering how you can call out the fact that that particular voluntarily remitted information does not carry with it the burden of a felony if you lie about it, because it's voluntary. It's not statutorily required now, or does it? If I decide to send you something that's not true, first, have I just committed a felony? And second, if I haven't, but I'm just wrong, how does the department express Representative Cameron's concern, which was to sell his car. No, not to sell his car. It was the two. What was your concern, Representative Cameron?
I don't know how many miles it really is.
Yeah, exactly. And the issue is, how does that lack of knowledge make its way onto the face of the title?
Chair Reed and Representative Bence, in terms of the sanction, the felony sanction applies only for those where it is required, so the 9 years and newer. So after that, once you're into year 11 and you voluntarily supply it, even if you're lying about it, the felony provisions under the federal law don't attach there. Now, there may be other sanctions for willfully
misleading,
falsifying DMV records. I'd have to look into that, but not that, those felony provisions for false odometer. And then in terms of knowing for certain that that has more or less reliability, again, I think over time, as we get further away from those 9 years that the federal government determined was at least somewhat reliable, I think it becomes maybe somewhat less reliable, but it is showing up on that title. And there is no way to know for certain, unless you own that car from driving it off the lot new, there's no way to know for certain that that is the accurate mileage.
Well, right, and the issue was, how would you recommend that anything be said on the face of the title regarding the fact that the information was provided voluntarily and therefore may be less reliable than that which carried the possibility of a felony?
Chair Reed and Representative Bence, that's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about that in terms of some kind of disclaimer actually even on the title, and I could consult the folks at DMV and noodle on that and get back to you with something that might be helpful.
Thank you.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Reed and Ms. Joyce. I have a question regarding the statute of limitations on odometer fraud. Should a newly minted driver in 1968 who might have chosen to borrow her father's white Impala convertible and put 220 miles on it that were unknown to the said parent and happened to be dating a young man of questionable character who knew how to roll an odometer back, want to go forward and confess that odometer was inaccurate when that car was sold, go into a DMV record and make a correction?
Maybe we need an amnesty clause. Circumstances. Is there an amendment coming, perhaps?
Chair Reed and Representative McEwen, I'd advise checking the box that says I can't swear to the odometer.
Excellent.
Thank you.
There you go.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are several things that have come up that I can get into the weeds and get as detailed as most people. And sometimes yes. I've been accused of overthinking something, you know. I think what we're talking about here is people write down the mileage on a title transfer if the car is 8 years old or 9 years old. It gets recorded. If they write it down and the car is 10 years old and they write it down, it's not recorded. What this bill does, it just says, regardless of the age of the car, the person is writing down the mileage in their handwriting, they're reading the odometer. The question is, does DMV put that number into the system or not? I think that's how simple it is. But I'm looking right now at the DMV form. I feel like I need to ask permission to use a visual aid. But
you don't need to ask. Go ahead.
I'm looking at a copy of the State of Oregon's Secure Odometer Disclosure Reassignment. And right at the top of the form, it says, federal and state laws require that you state a vehicle's mileage when there is a transfer of ownership. Failure to complete an odometer disclosure or providing a false statement may result in fines and or imprisonment. And then it cites the ORS. So it's right there at the top. It's a warning that you're not supposed to just put down any number that comes to mind.
Thank you. Other questions? That completes the list of people who have signed up to testify. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on the bill?
I'm going to suggest, before I close the public hearing, I guess I close the public hearing first on House Bill 3137 and open a work session on House Bill 3137. What I'm going to suggest, colleagues, is that we have the dash one amendments, which I think represent where the sponsor wants to go. So we might entertain those amendments. It seems like we have some additional investigation to do around the fiscal, but we could probably adopt the amendments so that we're in the consistent place with where the sponsor's intents are. Does that sound reasonable?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3137.
Thank you. Representative Cameron moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 3137. Is there a discussion? Any objection to the motion? I don't see any of the dash one amendments are adopted. And we are in work session. Is there any discussion that people want to have on the bill before we stop for today?
Move the bill.
I don't see any. So we'll be back to it, I imagine. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3137. And let you know that, unfortunately, I have another obligation on Wednesday, so you will be in the capable hands of Vice Chair Bentz for the meeting on Wednesday. And if there is nothing else to come before the committee today, we'll adjourn. Thank you.